We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
All right.
Have another round.
Yeah.
Let's start. We only have one local item this week, but Job has assured us it's a doozy.
Or at least fun.
Yeah, it's fun. So Brian Carver is the – we haven't paid much attention to the city council races this year. There's only two of them that are on the primary ballot, and then two more where there were only two candidates in the race, so it goes straight through to the general. And the incumbents are pretty heavily favored in each of them. The one that has gotten most attention, maybe because of the strong showing of Sean Sawant as a socialist, which is pretty unusual itself, is Richard Conlon's reelection race. The third candidate in that race is a guy named Brian Carver, who jumped into the race in April with $25,000 of his own money, has subsequently raised a fair amount of additional money, even though he really isn't saying anything particularly to distinguish himself from Richard Conlon or anything particularly interesting. So it kind of raises the question, well, why is he running? Some interesting stuff came to light over the last week over why he might be running. It has to do with where his money itself is coming from. It turns out that about three quarters of Carver's donors so far are from outside Seattle. And many of them, if you start Googling the names from the PDC website, the state ethics website, are associated with a India-based Quaijai religious group called the Art of Living, which has a guru who is considered by his followers to be infallible and who considers himself to be the reincarnation of Jesus, Buddha, and Muhammad. His name is Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, not to be confused with the musician. And that group operates in a number of countries, has several different subsidiaries who do various new agey / charitable things. And it turns out that many of Carver's donations come from that group. And if you follow that group to its United States and then local websites and pages, Brian Carver is the main contact for that group in Seattle. Now, the reason this is interesting, aside from the fact that the bulk of his money seems to be coming from this group, is that he has made no mention of this whatsoever at any point in his campaign. We've heard about his loving wife and young child. We've heard about where he works at the Kindle division of Amazon. But we haven't heard anything about the group that seems to be bankrolling his entire campaign, a number of people, judging from sort of the electoral history of campaigns funded by new agey organizations, that usually doesn't go over very well in American politics. We had something called the Natural Law Party that was extant in the 1990s, which was basically funded, again, part of an international movement, in this case, Transcendental Meditation, which in many ways is a lot more mainstream and accepted in the U.S. than this would be.
Yeah.
It raises the question of okay, why is he running? And why isn't he talking about this? The other thing that that turned out to be peculiar is that Carver, who works for Kindle, has a Kindle book himself. It's called Brian in Politics. And ostensibly talks about his 2009 experience when he had a brief run for city council in the race that Mary Sally Bagshaw eventually won. So Carver got 7% of the vote in the primary and didn't go through to the general that year. But if you preview it or download it, it isn't actually Brian in Politics. What it is a reprint of Mark Twain's Tom Sawyer, which is just weird. So nobody really knows what's going on with this guy, but the thing is that because he put his own money in the race and because he has been able to show additional money coming in, he's been treated as a mainstream candidate by local media and been treated as a credible candidate by local media, even though he really hasn't said anything during the race to distinguish himself, hasn't really shown any other reason to distinguish himself. And it really is a good example of, number one, how flawed the media coverage of these local races is, how the coverage is, because they're just using fundraising as a metric. They're not actually looking at who the candidates are, what they stand for, what they would do if elected. And most people see so little coverage now that there aren't that many places that report on local politics anymore. And with a very visible mayor's race this year, the council races are, and down ballot races like, you know, county council and the school board in Port of Seattle are getting even less attention than they usually do. Most people just don't have a lot of information about these races. So it's really quite telling. And, oh, by the way, speaking of not much information about these races, the state will be doing its endorsements again this year. And since the ballots will get mailed out next week, we'll start talking about that next weekend on this show.
All right. Moving on to national and the NSA.
Here. Yeah, I've got two or three different stories here on the whole NSA domestic surveillance program issue. This week, the revelations in The Guardian, and, you know, the revelations keep coming in The Guardian newspaper because of their contact with Edward Snowden. This week, the revelation was that Microsoft has been saying, well, we only give data to the NSA when they give us a court order. Well, yeah, the FISA court orders, as we know, are rubber stamp orders that the intelligence, the U.S. government's intelligence agencies, whenever they want data, they go to the FISA court. The FISA court rubber stamps their request, calls it a court order, and then these telecommunications companies and computer software companies like Microsoft have to comply. Well, Microsoft, it turns out, has been collaborating with the NSA.
Complying
isn't really how you should describe it. They've really been collaborating with the NSA quite a bit. Whenever they do an update to their software or their websites or other services, they give the NSA the key, is literally what's going on. So, for example, Microsoft gave the NSA pre-encryption, what they call pre-encryption stage access to email on Outlook.com and Hotmail. Their other email website, so that, you know, pre-encryption stage access means they can look at your email before it actually gets sent out, and is encrypted to go over the internet. Microsoft gave the FBI, in other examples, Microsoft gave the FBI access to SkyDrive. That's its online cloud storage service. So if you've decided you're going to put all of your data in the cloud, well, you better think again if you don't want the FBI just kind of rummaging through it.
Now, do we know if Google is doing that as well?
Well, we don't know. This all relates to Microsoft. Microsoft owns Skype, which is another online service that people enjoy because it can be free. You can use it as a free service for long distance video conferencing. Microsoft owns Skype, and Skype has worked with various government agencies to collect video and audio conversations. So it's not just on court orders. It's, you know, they collect these video and audio conversations, and then you have to just sort of trust these government spying agencies not to siphon through your content unless they have a warrant or an order to particularly look at your data.
Or somebody's bored on the lunch break or whatever.
Yeah, or whatever. Data provided to the NSA program, codenamed PRISM, that's their domestic surveillance program, doesn't just stay inside the NSA. It is shared with the FBI and the CIA, something that the Obama administration doesn't want you to know and has been denying. It actually is shared with the other intelligence agencies. And
all of whom have mandates in their charters not to spy on U.S. citizens.
Well, the CIA in particular has a mandate not to do domestic surveillance.
Well, so did the NSA originally.
Well, originally, yeah. But the CIA in particular, it says right in its charter, is not supposed to do spying on U.S. citizens, particularly in the United States. Now, meanwhile, the New York Times reported this week that the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, this is the court that issues these rulings, these court orders for spying, has issued numerous judicial rulings that constitute a secret body of law that's never been reviewed by any other court, according to the New York Times. They refer to the FISA court as a parallel Supreme Court. Except, of course, at the Supreme Court, both sides of an argument will be heard, whereas at the FISA court, only the government side is ever heard because it's a secret court, which no U.S. citizen who is not a member of the NSA, the CIA, the FBI, and the Department of Defense intelligence agencies will ever have access to.
The other difference is that the Supreme Court, the justices are at least approved by elected officials.
Yeah, in the case of the FISA court, that's not true. All of the 11 judges on the FISA court are appointed by Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, who many folks would refer to as an extreme conservative. And that's unprecedented that you have a secret court operating without any means of appeal or other kind of oversight. With only one person appointing the members of that. That's not even true for the Supreme Court. The president appoints the members, but Congress has to vote on and approve them. That's not the case with the FISA court. Now, the FISA court has also been ruling on a broad range of requests that involve not just terrorism and surveillance, but also things like nuclear proliferation, you know, cyber attacks or computer threats. Also, things like espionage and a vague category called other possible threats. All of these things don't relate at all to 9/11, which is what the Obama administration says all the FISA court orders really pertain to. Now, I also want to talk a little bit, too, about the fact that the FISA court, its orders and its rulings are issued usually by one judge at a time. It's not like the Supreme Court where all the judges sit down and they look at an issue and then they vote. That's not the case with the FISA court. It's usually one judge at a time is sitting there, reads through the order, and signs off on it. Because, of course, the FISA court, and I want to really point this out, the FISA court signed 1,800 orders last year, and not a single one was denied by the court. This is not the case in any other court in the nation. Now, the third thing I want to talk about in regards to the domestic spying program is that the Electronic Privacy Information Center this week decided to file an emergency petition with the Supreme Court asking them to stop the NSA's domestic surveillance program. Now, with this emergency petition, EPIC is really asking the Supreme Court to rule on a FISA court ruling. Basically, they're saying, look, if the Supreme Court determines that it can't make a ruling on FISA court order, then the FISA court really is a parallel Supreme Court, but one with absolutely no oversight, in which case they might then be able to challenge the constitutionality of the FISA court itself.
Yeah. No oversight and no transparency.
Yeah, no oversight, no transparency. It's all secret. Then it's probably not constitutional itself. So I think this is a very important lawsuit. It's not the first lawsuit to challenge the domestic spying program. The ACLU filed suit just a few weeks ago in New York federal court to challenge the NSA's domestic spying program. And a conservative group, the Freedom Watch, has also filed suit in federal court in Washington, D.C. So those are going ahead. But EPIC wants the Supreme Court to hear this emergency petition because they feel that there are no lower courts that have the ability to actually rule on a FISA court ruling. They believe only the Supreme Court can.
Moving on, a introduction of a new Glass-Steagall Act?
Yeah, four senators this week introduced a new bill called the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. Now, for folks who don't know what the Glass-Steagall Act was, it was a 1930s legislation that banned depository banks from investing on Wall Street. Now, depository banks were very different from investment banks. Depository banks are banks where you can deposit your money and you can have a checking account or savings account. You could take a loan for your business or a home loan or an auto loan, something like that. But if you wanted to take money somewhere to buy investment products or invest in Wall Street, you had to go to a different type of bank called an investment bank. Well, in the 1990s, through a series of stages, the Glass-Steagall Act was repealed, finally repealed in 1999. A lot of people have, including me, see that as one of the big steps in setting the stage for the financial collapse that happened in 2008. The repealing Glass-Steagall allowed depository banks to merge with investment banks. Investment banks don't just take customers' money and invest them in Wall Street. They also come up with their own investment products like derivatives, which can be very risky. And they also issue big loans, like margin loans, for people to invest money, which can also be a very risky practice. And they do other things, like they do their own kind of investing, buying and selling and trading, which can also get very, very risky.
It's also a key reason why the financial services sector has grown from 10% to nearly half of the nation's economy over the past couple decades. So repealing Glass-Steagall was extremely profitable for a lot of these companies.
It just happens
to take down the economy and ruin a lot of lives along the way.
Yeah. And so the four senators who introduced the bill include Maria Cantwell, our own Democratic senator, Elizabeth Warren, Democratic senator of Massachusetts, Republican Senator John McCain, and Angus King, who's an independent from Maine. So while it doesn't, I don't think it has a snowball's chance in hell, I think it's very important that people know that a very important piece of legislation is out there and deserves support. And I think you ought to call your senator and ask them to vote for it, or at the very least to argue for it and lobby for it.
Yeah, and thank Cantwell for her sponsorship of this, because it's a very necessary thing. And, you know, Cantwell is good on this issue and not as good on others, but on this one she deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, a prison strike in California.
Yeah, we heard about this when Ed Mead and Greg Lewis were on the program a few weeks ago, but it has expanded dramatically since then. In California, nearly 29,000 inmates across the state's entire prison system are now engaging in a hunger strike and refusing meals. It's gone on for several days at this point as a protest of prison conditions and rules. A number of the so-called supermax prisons in California, and for that matter, other prisons in California as well, are extremely restrictive of even basic things for inmates, such as the amount of time they get to spend outside their cells in the general population, and privileges, visitors from family, and so forth, and collective punishment for individual acts that violate the rules and so forth. And this has become the norm across the country, where over the past number of years, as you've seen more money go into the prison industrial complex, more involvement of private companies and prisons and such, so forth. One of the ways to cut costs is to take out the reform part of reformatories and see prisons now as strictly a punitive experience. And you have politicians also who are posturing as tough on crime by stopping coddling prisoners who by giving them the ability to eat and have clothes and stuff. In a lot of these cases, prisoners don't have access to work. They just sit there and rot all day long. So they got that going on in California, and not getting a lot of national news, even though an enormous number of prisoners are involved. The other thing that didn't get a lot of national news this week was a ruling by U.S. District Judge Gladys Kessler denying a lawsuit trying to force the U.S. to stop force-feeding hunger-striking prisoners at Guantanamo. Now, at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba, 166 foreign captives still remain there. Of them, 106 are on hunger strike, with 45 having been on that strike for long enough that they're being force-fed as of this week. Force-feeding being a pretty unpleasant experience, where you just have a tube down your throat
shoved
the whole
down,
time.
Shoved through your nose and down your throat.
Yeah. Of the 166 people that remain in Guantanamo, 86 of them, that is to say over half, were cleared for release or transfer years ago but are still being held in Guantanamo. According to the U.S. government, that's because they can't find other countries willing to accept them, which, of course, the U.S. has something to do with, since they were the one who labeled these largely innocent people terrorists to begin with. And all of the hunger strikers who were parties to those lawsuits are among people who have been cleared for release or transfer. So these are people who either were innocent or whose alleged crimes were relatively minor and certainly rise nowhere near the level of being held without trial or charges for over a decade. But they're in this limbo of, even though courts have cleared them for release, they're still being held. They're still being held in brutally inhumane conditions. And really the one thing that they can do that is left to protest that is simply refusing to eat. Of course, the U.S. isn't allowing that to proceed either.
And engaging in torture by force-feeding them.
It really is kind of a living hell kind of situation for randomly innocent people. And because this story has been going on for so long and it's kind of become part of the status quo since Democratic president and Congress have upheld it as well, it's just not getting in the news at this point, which is really, really kind of sad and appalling.
All right. Moving on, Illinois, change of law there.
Yeah, Illinois this week became the last U.S. state to allow concealed weapons by enacting a concealed carry law. Now, the state of Illinois didn't particularly want to, but it was forced to by the U.S. 7th District Court of Appeals. That's how we reacted to Aurora and to Newtown, not by making it harder to get guns and for people to carry around guns, but to make it easier. Meanwhile, this week, the surviving Boston Marathon suspect was formally charged with 30 counts, among them deploying a weapon of mass destruction. And that kind of raises the question that, you know, a lot more people died in Aurora and a lot more people died in Newtown than died in the Boston Marathon. So why aren't those high-capacity magazine firearms considered weapons of mass destruction? Just wondering.
Yeah.
Moving on, Walmart having some troubles.
They're having troubles. They're just holding their breath until they threaten to turn blue. And this is a story of Walmart in our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., where the District of Columbia City Council had for years resisted, much as the city of Seattle has, allowing Walmart inside the city limits. Finally capitulated last year, and now Walmart, after years and years of struggle to try and lure the council into accepting its stores, has three in the planning stages in different parts of the district, and it's planning to pull the plans on all of those because the council is now on the verge of approving a livable wage law. And of course, Walmart doesn't want anything to do with a livable wage law because they don't pay livable wages. The district law in question specifies big retailers, and particularly big box stores like Walmart, as needing to comply with it. Now, that's going to be an issue for all of the different big box stores, the Targets and the big grocery stores and so forth. But it's particularly an issue for Walmart because Walmart, on average, compared to other big box stores, pays its employees 28% less. Their wages are by far the lowest of any of those national chains. And they are trying, you know, Walmart, always the lowest wages, always. Yeah. And trying to throw their muscle around to force governments to not require other employers to pay a livable wage as well.
Yeah, which people should keep in mind when they go shop at Walmart, that yes, you're getting things cheaper, but the people who are serving you are also not getting paid very darn much.
And the people who make the goods are not getting paid much
hardly
either.
Hardly anything at
because,
all. Yeah.
Because Walmart is notorious for forcing its subcontractors in other countries that outside the U.S. that supply most of its goods to keep wages and work as low as possible and working conditions as bad as possible.
Mm-hmm. All right. On to climate change and CO2.
Yeah, some good news and some bad news. The good news is for trees, broadleaf trees, according to a paper published in the journal Nature. Broadleaved trees are using less water for new growth. This is because of rising levels of carbon dioxide in the air from, you know, human activity. This means trees can partially close their leaf pores and still get plenty of CO2 for growth. Trees, you know, humans need oxygen, trees need CO2. Remember your basic biology. That means, of course, if they can close their leaf pores and still get plenty of CO2, That means that there'll be less water evaporating from the tree's leaves, and so trees don't need to pull as much water from the soil, which in an era of global warming and less water available for plants, that's good news for trees, particularly for trees in temperate forests where the other climate conditions are good for trees to grow. But it's not so good for nearby farmlands. And you might ask why? Well, because water that evaporates from the leaves of trees becomes water vapor. That means moisture in the air that's carried as rain to farmlands that are downwind of major forests. And of course, less water taken up by trees means less water in the air, which means less water for less water as rain and for farmlands. And that means drought conditions in the world's major farm areas. For example, you can look at the western United States, where trees are dying for various reasons, including wildfires, which we've seen a lot of in the past month, pests, which are proliferating because of unseasonably warm winters, and persistent drought, drought being the total absence of water, not just less water. As more trees die here in the West, we've been seeing that we're losing one of the best tools now that nature has to pull us out of our long-term drought. So good news if you believe that nature should prevail. Bad news if you have a little bit of investment in the stake of the human race.
All right. And finally, two different garment factory agreements.
Yeah, for Bangladesh, two garment factories agreements were announced this week, one very good and one very, very bad. First, the good one. The European retailers came out with what they call the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh. 70 retailers, mostly European, have signed on to this agreement, including H&M, Carrefour, Marks & Spencer's, Inditex, which owns the Zara brand, and CNA, the big Dutch retailer. The only American companies to sign on to the European Accord are PVH, which owns Calvin Klein and Tommy Hilfiger, Abercrombie & Fitch, and Sean John. The Accord specifies that the companies, the retailers that have signed on, will ensure that there's money available to make safety improvements to Bangladesh's garment factories, and that all factories that they use will be inspected within 9 months from the start of the Accord. Wealthy factory owners, of course, would be required to put up their money for improvements, but if the owners of the factories don't have the money available, the retailers will figure out a way to provide it. And the workers will have input into the process, but they will also be paid while any factory remains closed for repairs. So that's a powerful incentive for factory workers to start making their improvements now before an inspector comes along and shuts them down. Now, the bad agreement is the American agreement. It's called the Alliance for Bangladesh Worker Safety. 17 U.S. retailers have signed on to that one, including our good friend Walmart, Gap, Target, Macy's, JCPenney, Kohl's, Carter's, and the Children's Place have all signed on to that one. It sets up a fund of about $42 million to be spent over 5 years, which is really peanuts when you think about the fact that thousands of garment factories in Bangladesh would be part of this.
$8 million a year, or about what, $1,000 a factory? Maybe?
Yeah. It's, well, less than that. It's to be spent over 5 years total, and it's not really for improvements to the factories. The money is going to be used for inspections, education, worker outreach, an anonymous hotline, et cetera, and if anything's left over, it might be used to fund improvements. Mostly, factory improvements will be funded by making the owners get loans if they can afford it. And the inspections, of course, won't be independent like the inspections under the European Accord. The inspectors will be hired by the retailers themselves. And the inspections won't be transparent, so we won't know which factories are being inspected, who the inspectors are, what the results of the inspections are, et cetera.
This sounds like a PR exercise.
It is. It really is. It's a voluntary alliance, meaning that any retailer can drop out of the alliance at any time, and there are only minor financial penalties for doing that. So if you believe, as I do, that the American retailers should sign on to the European Accord, you should probably check out some of the groups that are trying to put pressure on them. Those groups include the Workers' Rights Consortium, the Clean Clothes Campaign, and my favorite, which is United Students Against Sweatshops.
And not just for Bangladesh also, but the European agreement should also be used as a model for similar factories in any number of other countries as well.
Yes.
Events.
One event coming up this week on Wednesday, July 17th from 4 to 6. There will be a rally to demand compassionate release for the attorney Lynn Stewart, who was, as some people may remember, imprisoned several years ago for her role assisting as a lawyer, a person prosecuted post 9/11 under the Patriot Act. That rally again Wednesday from 4 to 6 at the U.S. District Court Plaza in downtown Seattle at 700 Stewart Street.
Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. And as mentioned, we're ramping up for our annual primary endorsements. Those will be coming out later this coming week.